CataractCoach.com, podcast series, episode number 140 with Dr. Joaquin de Rojas, achieving great success in private equity practices. Plus, remember, the key is to keep your curiosity and challenge yourself. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I have a very special guest, a surgeon who has a really interesting path in life here and has now become one of the busiest surgeons that I know, and that is Dr. Joaquin de Rojas. Joaquin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Uday. It's always a pleasure to chat with you. You've been an amazing mentor through the years and a wonderful person. So,
if only my kids believed that, would be in good shape. But now, I got to admit here, you're a very young doctor. I don't see much gray hair at all, just maybe a tiny bit on the sides, little bit.
It's coming in.
But you're already a very, very high volume surgeon. Tell me your path in ophthalmology. How did you get into ophthalmology? What did you do? What were your first jobs? What are you at now?
My path was a little unconventional because when I was a med student, I didn't envision myself as an ophthalmologist in the beginning, partly because I didn't really know what it would have been like.
Sure.
Now, as you know, our exposure in med school to ophthalmology is pretty low.
Yeah,
but sure. I did have a pretty awesome week. I was at Penn Med, and we had this really nice week. And I always thought in my mind, wow, that could be a nice path. But at the time, I was pretty interested in neurosurgery. And sure. That's without actually ever having done it, of course. At least the idea of it was very appealing to me. And so that was the path that I thought I was going down. And it took me to starting, residency program in neurosurgery.
Oh, you started your residency program already? Wow.
Yeah, that's right. So I had shadowed throughout med school. I'd done a lot of work in neurosciences, neurosurgery, and I had a mentor there, Jay Storm, who's now the head at CHOP, and he's a good friend of mine. And he what he did was just amazing, and I just loved the idea of being able to reestablish function in people, which is what neurosurgeons do. Probably a lower success rate than ophthalmologists, but that is the idea, right? So I really love the idea of it. And I love ophthalmology, but I just thought, my mind is sort of set. I'm going down this path of neurosurgery. And I got into my top choice, and I was excited to start. But what I quickly realized was the morbidity and the mortality was very hard to stomach for me, as I did the rounds in the ICU. And you could have a perfect surgery and you still have a patient who's paralyzed or brain dead or, whatever.
So how many years of nursing did you end up doing?
I just did 1 year.
Okay.
Yeah, 1 year of it was like a neurosurge, gen surge combo year. But in that year, it was a very trying time, and it's a very tough residency, as I'm sure you're aware.
Sure.
Yeah, so it was a combination, but it was really the idea of like, what do I want to do when I'm done with all of this? And when I realized that this is not my path, then I had to make a pivot. And I thought back to the things that excited me in the first place about medicine, which is being able to help people, being able to improve their health with my hands as a surgeon, and the diagnostics are also very interesting to me. And ophthalmology was like a great fit. And I thought back, let me rethink about this. And so I reached out to some old mentors and leaders in ophthalmology within at Penn, and they helped me to get on track. And I also reached out to the program director at Columbia, which is where I was doing my residency for ophthalmology at the time. And he was, Brian Nguyen, he's now at UCSF, I think. And he kind of took me with open arms, and he said, come take a few days with us, check it out. And it was a good fit, and they took a chance with me. And I did some rotations there as a surgery first year. And I was able to transition into ophthalmology the next year without really missing a beat. So I was super fortunate.
You didn't have to do like a match all over again. And
I did get into it as a backup. I did get into that match, but I ended up not needing to. So I got super lucky. Yeah.
The neurosurgery people must have been a little bit upset, though. You filled up one of their key spots, and there are very few residency spots here for neurosurgery, and then you drop out or you change gears. They weren't upset?
They were actually surprisingly understanding. You know, it's not the first time someone's dropped out of a neurosurgery program. I think they really want people that want to be there 100%. No questions asked. They're willing to take a grueling residency and life. And I really admire those people because they were phenomenal, exceptional residents and attendings at that place. And I have utmost admiration for them, but they also just want to be with people that really want to be there, you know, and they really love it. And so I think it was, they said, hey, look, you have a lot of talent. We love you, but if there's another path for you, we want you to bring value to society in the way that you think is best. Yeah. So they were very understanding.
But how did they fill your spot, your vacancy?
They were able to, I think they took on a third resident the next year.
Mm.
And then they have a research year in there in those 7 years. So they were able to sort of finagle it and make it not be too damaging at all. So they were to get by. And everyone was, like I said, everyone was super understanding. I remember my chief resident at the time, this guy, Ben Kennedy, who's now a successful neurosurgeon. He was just amazing people and with great understanding. And I think they just realized, yeah, you figured it out and good luck to you and we'll be fine. And they were fine. And So I was blown away by that. And I'm really glad I made that decision. It was the right decision for me. I found a calling in ophthalmology, and it also led, you know, it's one of those things. It was one of those hardest decisions I ever made because no one wants to feel like a quitter. And it was a very tough time. But I just thought to myself, you can only make one good decision at a time. And sure, you can't think about every possibility. What's this going to look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now? You have an idea, but you just have to think about the decision in front of you. And my decision was, I can't do this anymore in good faith. Mm-hmm. It was a good decision because it led me to the career path that I wanted. And it also led me in my personal life, something I wanted, where I met my wife, my future wife, my first year as an ophthalmology resident.
Wow,
as my co-resident.
Very cool.
Yeah. So a little unconventional.
After residency at Columbia, then you went to Wilmer.
Then I did ophthalmology residency at Columbia, and then I did Wilmer Fellowship in cornea cataract refractive. And then I knew going through it, people thought, oh, he's a neurosurgeon. He's going to want to do retina or maybe some neuro-op in there or something. Nice. But no, I guess I surprised everyone again because I really liked cataract surgery and cornea and refractive. So I really fell in love with cataract surgery as a resident. I think our team, meaning me, my wife, my future wife at the time, our other two co-residents, we ended up doing the most cataract surgeries ever, you know, as a group. And we did that by working together and using, as chief residents, you know, using our junior residents to help us, but also train them in the process and how to recruit, how to optimize workflows. And we ended up, setting a pretty high bar there for what's possible in a New York City program, which are traditionally known to not be very high volume.
What were you able to achieve for your class? So the four of you did on average, what, 300 phacos?
Yeah, about some. No, not even that many. But, you know, the average was like 100 something.
Okay, gotcha. So
going somewhere between 250 and 300, that was like great, you know, for us. There's so many programs out there that are much superior than that. But for us, it was the best we could do. And I had a great education there. I had a great experience. And then at Wilmer, you got more into learn a little bit more about cataract surgery, definitely a lot more about refractive and cornea. And but that's just the beginning, you know.
Of course.
That it set the stage, and it gave us some analytical skills and some basic fund of knowledge. But from there, the amount of learning that's occurred for me personally is probably 10x.
Oh, for sure. I always say it doesn't matter how many cases you're doing your residency, to be very frank, because even if you do 500, at best, you're halfway up the learning curve. At best.
I feel like I had two fellowships. I had the fellowship at Wilmer, and then I had about a 2 year fellowship in my first two years of practice.
Tell me about that. So you finished your fellowship, and then what did you do?
So then I was looking, I knew I liked I knew I was primarily interested in high volume cataract surgery. And, you know, I think your channel was starting to get pretty popular at that, starting to get popular, but it wasn't, this was like 2018.
Okay.
So I think you were starting to come in like 2019-ish or something. So I didn't have.
Yeah. The cataract coach idea started, the beginning of 2018. So.
Yeah. So it was right around. So I wish I had had it. But I knew that's what I wanted to do. And we were looking at different places and it ended up being that Florida was a place where I had some family on one coast, but we found this location, this practice setting on the west coast of Florida, which is a little foreign to us, but we fell in love with it. And we thought it was a great opportunity for both professional and you know, personal reasons. So we signed on to a private practice there. And that was known to be high volume, great surgeons.
And that's where you are now.
Still here.
That's amazing.
I'm here right now. Yeah. Yeah. It's been quite a journey. And, you know, I think I've talked to you throughout some of it, but it's been overall very positive.
Tell us about your practice situation now. So what's it like? What's your week like? What's your volume? This kind of thing.
So typical week, let me think. So I guess we'll have about maybe three full clinic days on average, maybe two and a half even. But they're very focused clinic days where we do a lot of co-management with external optometrists, both internal and external. So when I'm seeing a patient, it's either a surgical evaluation for cataract surgery or refractive or cornea, or it's just a very complex case, like a tertiary referral for some sort of cornea issue or something like that, you know, or lens-based issue. So that's what I'm seeing. I'm not seeing any comprehensive patients or bloaters or anything like that. So then, you know, if I'm only seeing, let's say 16 patients or 18 patients in a half day, you could bet that 75% of those lead to surgery or more, right? So it's very congested. And then I have about two half OR days a week. And those are very focused, I should say, and packed with cases. Yeah. So like, you know, on a typical, I've lowered it now, but I would say in a typical half day, I'm doing somewhere between 30 and 36 cases.
Oh, that's great. Let's say like 60 a week, so times 5 weeks, so 3,000 cases a year. Good clip, really good clip.
Yeah, it doesn't quite end up being that high, but it's definitely up there, and that's been a gradual progression. So it didn't start that way, although it did start pretty high. I think that was one of the advantages of the situation I was in. Not to say it was a perfect situation, and that, you know, nothing is, but that was one of the advantages, that it exposed me to a lot of surgery where it almost felt like too much in the beginning. And it was very challenging because you want to do well for patients, but then you have the added pressures of feeling like you need to, there are all these patients come in, you got to treat them and you got to get it done in an efficient way because it all feeds on itself, right? The more efficient you are, the more ASC time you get, the more clinic time you get, but you want to always maintain quality. So you're in that push and pull, and it forces you to be better, right? And it forces you to be better in the OR and in clinic, and it forces you to be efficient. But the beginning can be tough because it's like boot camp. And that's why I said those 2 years were like my second fellowship.
Now you're doing, let's say, 30 something cases. Are you using one OR, two ORs, three?
Yeah, so we're doing 37 cases. We're using two ORs. Our team is amazing. They're just super efficient, and you know, we can crank. We can do 10 cases an hour if everything's humming, and we have another room with the laser as well. So that's one of the things that drew me to this place, was that they had created a really good system. David Shoemaker is our founder. He was known for this, and Bill Lehners was another high volume surgeon here, and they had created a really powerful system where you do a lot of cases, and that's what attracted me to it. But then I had to sort of get the skills to even be able to keep up at all.
I mean, so 10 in an hour is quite the clip, right? So that's 6 minutes a case, basically. Take away 30 seconds walking to and from the room. You look at 5 minutes a case. Right. And then you must enter the room, this basically just immediately in the gown and gloves, and the speculum's already in.
And then you're basically a minute turnaround time is what, you know, the turnaround is within a minute.
Right.
Between, and then you're in the other room, and then, yeah. I mean, it didn't start out like that. You know, in the beginning, I took my time and, you know, I was doing 15 minute cases. And, but then over time, it's the atmosphere, it's the culture that I think just, you end up adapting, you know, and then you have to be dedicated to it, and you have to be persistent and methodical and just reflective. Reflecting all the time on how things went, how they can go better, watching videos. I spent a lot of time when I wasn't as busy in the beginning, just time in the OR, just watching these guys, these masters of their craft, like you, just doing it and looking at the nuances. Like, where are they putting their second instrument there? What's their, when that's happening, how are they moving it to get those pieces to sort of rotate in a way where it more efficiently gets into the phaco piece with causing minimal edema. Just the littlest of the details, it's like the more surgery I did, the more questions I had. And then I would go back to the OR and look at specifically how they managed that. I would ask, I would kind of be a pain in their butts, I think, because I was always asking questions and going to them. But I think after a year or two, you know, I developed like probably a list or a document of like 10 or 15 pages of nuanced details about cataract surgery and other surgeries as well. But even just the cataract part was probably like 10 pages. And I would review it every time before every case. I would read every single line. And then whatever, you know, when you see vitreous or something, you know, occasionally, what do you do in that situation? How do you make that better? So just that attention to detail and, you know, your willingness to review all the plan A, plan B, plan C's, that all helps. It gives you more confidence. And over time, you're just developing your muscle memory so that the unusual becomes usual. So the weird stuff that was weird, that made you think twice at first, makes you not think twice. The founder here, his name's David, he said something that at first really took me aback. And he said, the OR is no place to think. And you think about it, you're like, hold on. That's not what I was taught. But this is what he meant, right? And it took me a while to understand what he means, is that you get to a place where, at least for the routine cases, right? And even the non-routine cases, it all starts becoming muscle memory. Mm-hmm. So if you catch yourself thinking like, what do I do here? What do I do there? What do I do with my hand here? You're probably not being very efficient, and it means that your motor memory is not attuned yet, because you're relying too much on your frontal cortex. Frontal cortex is good, but you shouldn't have to. Once you get to a point, it's almost like you're in a flow state. Yeah, and you're in that flow state, you're not really in that state of pure cerebral analysis that comes after and before. You should have that should all be there beforehand and afterwards, the case. But when you're in there, you really shouldn't be, unless you're trying something new or unless you're in training, right? When I was training, I was very cerebral. And when I have a new, when I'm starting and try to do Yamani for the first time, I'm very cerebral in there, or, you know, but eventually the goal is to not have to be cerebral.
Right. Be in the state of flow. Well, I have a good cataract coach video about that, about being in the state of flow. Right. But you're right. But there's one thing you may miss out on, though. You don't get, my favorite day is actually post-op day one. I see all my own post-op. So post-op day one, I just love the amount of like happiness that the patients have, and they're so thankful. And it's just like, wow, you missed that.
You're right. In the beginning, I would see a lot of my same post-ops. Yeah. Even now, I do occasionally see my own post-ops, people I know. Just certain patients, I'll see them. And you're right. It's amazing. At least one way that I, you know, because you do want to see your outcomes, right? Of course. Sure. So one thing that I do a lot of back-to-back surgery. So we don't do same day bilateral, but I'll operate on Wednesday and then I'll do the next eye on Thursday. So we do see those patients during the second eye day on Thursday. my team will see those patients downstairs right before surgery to see how their first eye did. Sure. And I'll have a sticky note with their vision and their pressure and how they're looking. So I'll see that right before I go in the OR. So that keeps me, puts a little smile on my face.
Yeah, of course.
One. And then it keeps me also attuned to any little changes that I'm making. Is it causing more edema? You know, this type of stuff. So that's one way to do it. The other way to do it is to have really good relationships with your optometrist. Mm-hmm. And they should report to you when something is unusual immediately. You're always available to them to see a patient. If there is a complication or something, you're immediately available to assist and to see that patient. So there are ways to do this and still, be very involved with the patients, but you're right. There's such a pleasure to seeing your good work right out there. You're right about that. And I get letters like this. I was just reading this one here today. It's funny you said it. This letter from a patient's daughter was just like, you know, you probably don't get to see some of your patients all the time, but the DSEC and cataract surgery that you did on my dad has totally changed his life. Yeah, and I just wanted to tell you that. And I did see him post-op initially, but I hadn't seen him in like a year. So, you know, you get letters like this that remind you. That,
yeah, of course. I mean, we're very fortunate to be ophthalmologists. But you were saying earlier too, in the OR really is about the team. Now, I had a few videos on Cataract Coach where I actually have put my phone over the camera on the wall of the room and just kind of film the whole room. And, you know, basically as important as me is that scrub tech. Like when I was, you know, and this was a video from a few years ago, I don't even look up from the scope. And the instrument just appeared in my hands. It's just like, it's literally like a ballet. It's like a beautiful dance. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason you can be so efficient with these cases, hyper efficient. And also, again, you're in that state of flow. You don't have to, you're right. You're not thinking too much. You're just kind of going with it. In that state of flow, things just happen beautifully.
You're so right about that. It's a team effort. When I first started, the scrub techs who were very seasoned, they were like, you know, you're doing things a little differently. And I was like, how so? You keep taking your eyes out of the scope. Keep taking your eyes out of the scope to look for instruments or to ask for instruments. He's like, don't do that. And just you should always be in the scope and your hands are just doing this. You don't even have to reach. You just go like this with your hands and they put it in there. And yeah, you never have to say, I need my chopper. They'll know exactly what you need. And it's just, if you look at it, it's just this. And you're just looking in the scope the whole time. And it took me a while to get into that. But as I watched these guys do it and I saw that the scrub techs, you have to trust the scrub techs. You know, and they have to trust you and you have to develop that. So it's definitely, you're right. It is a nice dance. And when it works, you can get into that state of flow, which is pretty awesome.
For sure. Now tell us about your practice kind of setup here. Cause you're very unusual. Cause this is your first job you've had is your only job. So.
Yeah. I am unusual. So it started off as, I was building up my practice and establishing my relationships in the community. And as time went on, I just started getting busier and busier. Yeah. And then most recently, taking a more leadership position in the practice.
Great.
And we're part of a larger PE-backed platform called USI. And I've taken on, as time has gone on, I've realized that the way for me to be happy in this organization is to take on more of a leadership role.
Sure.
Because at least then I feel like the destiny is a little bit more in my hands, not to say that it's fully in my hands, but it's more, you know, and I look up to a lot of people that have started their own practice and, you know, some people that have gone, some doctors that have started the way I did and have moved on. And I look up to people like you because then you have total control. Right. But I think that if you show yourself to be pretty valuable and you in multiple ways as a surgeon, but otherwise, I think that it's possible to gain some more influence. And to me, that's important. I just think if I don't feel like I have influence over my patient's care or even the way things are handled, then it's not a place that I would want to be in. So for me, it sort of has evolved with me a little bit, and that has been positive. That's why I've been here for as long as I have. And then my wife also joined the practice. She started off, she's an ophthalmologist too, Priya Matthews. I know you interviewed her. And she started about 2 years after I did here in this practice. And she's done awesome. I mean, I learned a lot from her because you know, the way that she's able to, I don't know, her interpersonal relation skills are fantastic. She commands so much loyalty among her staff and her referring optometrist and her friends, and you know, it's amazing. I learned a lot from her as well.
Yeah, a lot of young ophthalmologists have sometimes don't realize that you can have many different paths in ophthalmology. What can do, like you're doing now, where you're working for a larger private equity group, owned group. You can do a private practice. You can do academics. And by the way, these days, academia is a lot more like private equity than anything else. It's really changed a lot. But again, you can certainly do any of these paths and be successful and be happy. And then also, you can also change gears. So I actually do less surgery now than I did 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. I don't want to do hard anymore. I used to drive to 3 different locations in LA, do a ton of surgery, and there were weeks that I'd do in a week, 60, 80, sometimes even 100 cataracts for the week. I just don't have that desire anymore. I'd rather, like, I've now changed my practice, and that's okay too. I think super high volume is fantastic for a younger surgeon, but mm-hmm. some priorities will end up changing though, and that's okay too.
Well, I can see that for sure. And I mean, think about all you do. I mean, you provide value in so many ways with this channel and everything. And yeah, I mean, look, I think of it this way too. I don't consider myself as, I'm an ophthalmologist and that's my identity. I mean, it's what I do for a living. It's what I love to do, but I feel like we're all so much more than that as well. And we need to make time for our hobbies, our family, you know, our kids, our wife, our husband, whatever.
For sure.
And all these other things that make us human, you know, and I think you've done that. Amazingly, you're an example of that, and things change over time. You know, our interests change, our life situations change, but I do think for young ophthalmologists, I think there are certain advantages of being in a situation like I'm in, where you just get inundated with volume, and right. you're forced to become good. It's like sink or swim. There's some advantage to that, you know, because I think had I gone into private practice off the bat. I just feel like I wouldn't have gained skills as quickly as I did.
Well, sure. You need to do volume basically to become better and better. That's no question about that. I think every surgeon will be better at case 10,000 compared to case 1,000.
Right.
So certainly you're going to progress in your learning a bit faster with that. But yeah, again, it's just a lot of young people are worried that they're different kind of, am I going to be okay? What if I'm doing, you know, very low volume at the beginning? It all works out. I promise it does. And then I think too, is there always bigger fish? Like I was recently giving a lecture in Argentina with one of my great friends, Neto Rossatelli from Brazil, who does, this is no joke, 500 cataracts a week.
I watched his, some of his videos on your channel.
Yeah, so he's an amazing surgeon, but he's tailored it. He's given up his private clinic. He just works for the public health system, and he just does 5 days a week in the operating room. He has no clinic days. So again, anything's possible. You can certainly keep changing it with changing your priorities with time. And then at your stage, I think it's fantastic. Once you get to 10, 20, 30,000 cases done, you think, okay, wait a minute. This is kind of a little bit of the same thing over and over again.
Maybe yeah.
Taper off a little bit, change gear, do something a little bit different. And then now I don't do any co-management here in LA. It's just it's a very unusual environment here where it just seems like it's just a bidding war and I don't want any part of that. So I'm not doing any co-management. But I am doing less volume now and I really try to give every patient the same care that I'd want to receive. So for me, yeah. If you check into my clinic, you won't wait 5 minutes, ever. This is what is just crazy to think. In the surgery center, every step is exactly how I want to do it. I meet every patient before surgery and say, hey, just reviewing with you. Okay, we're doing it right eye, doing best distance vision with this lens. And okay, we're on the same page. And that kind of care, I think they'd like a lot. So I've changed gears a lot now in the last
That's amazing. 10 years. Yeah, yeah, I mean, those are the priorities that are important, and they're important for me too. You know, there are more extreme versions of what I do.
Oh,
there are
sure.
doctors that you talk to that they don't see their patients even preoperatively.
Right.
They see them on the day of surgery. That's too far for me. You know, right. I there is something, I love the fact that in my community, like I'm in this golf community where we live, and all these patients come to me because they heard, you know, they heard me or my wife. I love that the nurses that work here come to me for their cataract surgery and my colleagues, you know, and all that. That tells me that I'm still keeping that humanistic side alive, and I always want to do that. And the moment that is not there will be a moment where I might pivot.
Right.
Right. So, and I think the other thing is too, that the place that I'm at right now, it's, you know, I work about 4 days a week. It's also allowed me to pursue a lot of other interests, like, you know, a lot of the stuff that I'm doing with industry or with AI, and a lot of research that I've done, that I've worked with companies. And that's very important to me. You know, if I was, and yeah. I also like to throw in some of the complicated stuff in there too, because it challenges me intellectually within ophthalmology. I don't think I would just want to do cataracts nonstop. Not to say, I mean, I think there's a lot to it, and I do love cataract surgery, but I do like to diversify a little bit as well. You know, yes.
So, tell us, well, what's the one nice thing about being for a, you know, part of a bigger group? You don't have to run a business. You can get involved, like you said, in leadership positions if you'd like to. But the nice part is you do have time away that you don't have to run a business. You can actually pursue other things. Now, tell us about your AI projects. What are you working on with that?
Yeah, so I just became interested. Actually, you know, this was around the time when we were working together on something. And, you know, you have the Lattice formula. You got involved with AI very early, you know, sure. John Lattice and John. And back then, before ChatGPT, right? So when I started thinking about the problems that I'm facing and the things that interest me, I realized technology has always been at the forefront, but I never really knew how to program. So I started around COVID, I started thinking about, why don't I just bite the bullet? I feel like I need this for my data analysis. I feel like I need this. Mm-hmm. Machine learning's taking over. I want to learn more about this. And I want to be able to just make custom applications for things that I need for my business, because I do feel like I'm contributing to the business here, but also for my outcomes. You know, everything. So I started learning how to code, and I took some good courses on that. And then when the large language models came out, like ChatGPT, it really changed the game in terms of how fast I could learn how to code. Yeah, and it also just showed me what's possible, mm-hmm. you know, what's coming. It was ChatGPT, the first one. And then it was my Tesla when I was driving on its, you know, it was driving on its own. And I was like, all right, the stuff with deep learning is there's something here. This is going to change the world. Mm. So I just wanted to be part of it, you know, yeah. And even if it's a very small part. So I've just got more and more involved with creating sort of, you know, custom applications to help me with my own data analytics, my own outcomes analysis, some stuff that I do for the practice as a whole to help with, whether it's on the marketing front or our patient access center. Mm-hmm. To create chat agents or tools that our call center can use to better triage patients and be able to, because that's a big task right now. It's yeah. very hard to get for these big groups to get a good functioning call center. We still have a lot of work to do, but technology is going to really disrupt that. And it already is. So everything from that to a calculator that I created to help the accounting folks sort of figure out how much staff do we allocate to different providers depending on their volume or their revenue and stuff like that. So there have been so many applications personally that I've had that I've created. And then also I've just partnered with different startups to get involved as well. You know, one of them was your startup in the beginning. But then also Raya AI, which is this company here based in Sarasota that creates agentic workflows. So using AI to basically augment or replace human workers. And they've been involved in my own practice. And then also more recently, I partnered with this company Visionary as an investor, but also advisor. And they're really interested in being able to query EMRs and scheduling systems to ask and answer questions that would normally take weeks and weeks to answer in a team of people. Like an example that I recently used, if you see glaucoma patients and you're wondering how many of these glaucoma patients am I actually performing MIGS on, or how many did I miss the ball or drop the ball on and forgot to do that, or our optometrist did or whatever, refer them for that. So how would you figure that out? You'd have to like have a team of people go through the EMR records and try to figure that out. But what if you could just integrate a ChatGPT like LLM into the EMR and you just ask it in plain English, give me a report of all the glaucoma patients that we've seen and whether they would have been eligible for a MIGS procedure based on if they had one or two drops and then they had cataract surgery on that one or two drops that they didn't get that MIGS procedure. How many was it? What years? List it. Yada, yada, yada. It thinks for like a few minutes and now you have a beautiful report of everything, right? So I believe that, I mean, that's data analytics, right? But there's so many applications like this that we're just starting to scratch the surface in ophthalmology. It's going to be pretty wild.
Yeah, I think it's there are a lot of things coming, a lot of things coming. But yeah, it'd be nice to have things like when someone calls the clinic, have an automated AI basically to talk them through, okay, what's your symptoms? Okay, this go down this tree, a few more questions. Okay, sounds like you have a PVD that's developing. Okay, sounds like your risk for RD stuff is relatively low. And then triage that patient, be okay, we'll check you like, not urgently, but maybe in a week or two, as opposed to like come in today if it's more RD-like symptoms. Right. Have it all automated.
Well, these things are so smart already, just even the frontier models on their own. Like if you ask, you know, one of these models, these things, they know it a lot of times, but sometimes they don't. So then what you do is you augment that with your own personal database, a vector store, they call it, where you feed it your own data, your own way of doing things, your own examples, and then it gets even smarter. Mm-hmm. And then the third step is to rate it. So then you start using it, and if it answers something the way you'd like, then that's a good thing. That, you know, that's human feedback, it's called reinforcement learning. And then if it's not something good, then you correct it, or you have a team and you correct it to how you want, and then it learns more. So then now you're just refining it. And it's amazing what you can get to. I mean, if you have the ChatGPT app, for example, and you use the advanced voice feature and you tell it to role play as this call center agent, you'd be surprised at how human it sounds, how well it answers questions. And this is with no additional training.
Right.
So absolutely. I do think it's important currently to keep a human in the loop. When you start getting to these agentic workflows, where agentic meaning that the LLM is kind of end to end, it's not just a tool that you're using for your workflow, but it's something that can do things on its own. When you start getting into that realm, it's getting really good, but you still want, I believe you're still going to need a human at least for the next 5 years, let's say. To verify, right? Trust.
Yeah, for sure. It's changing a lot. I mean, when I first started using ChatGPT as an example, I did one of these funny tests where you say, okay, which states or how many states have the letter like R in their name? And it'd be wrong. Mm-hmm. Like wrong answers. It'd be like Iowa. I'm like, no. But now obviously that's gotten better and better. I used it recently asking for about a value on a used car. And it came up with an answer. I was like, you know, that's wrong, because this is a collector car. This is not like your typical used car. And so I said, no, you're wrong. And it says, oh, then it rethinks and comes with a new answer. But it's like, yeah, every month I use it, it tends to get better and better.
It's better. And now it starts using tools. So tools is important, because now it can access the web, you know, or it can access your own database. So by pulling new information, then it pulls that in and then it reasons with that. Because if you use a raw LLM, what you're doing is you're just using
everything is out there.
Pre-learned patterns, but there's a cutoff date, right? They're pre-learned patterns of thinking, pattern recognition based on the internet's information. But once you start adding tools where you can give it live data, then you see the performance really go up. Yeah, and that's what's happening.
Yeah, I'm trying to actually make one for Cataract Coach where it's like, use the data from Cataract Coach as the basis. I want you to be able to say, okay, I'm having trouble learning horizontal chop. And I wanted to spit out, okay, watch these six videos. And here's this is kind of what I'm looking for right now. It's obviously a lot more complicated than I think, unfortunately.
I can connect you to someone that can help you with that.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too is I need to get all the, basically, I probably have to transcribe or get automated transcription for all my videos to have that as a data set too.
Oh yeah, you can do that pretty easily too. Yeah, so it's cool stuff. And you know, when I was with you guys and we were talking about the lattice formula, about a formula that can make anyone better, right? That's kind of the thing that you talk about, because when you take AI is this term we use now, but it's really based on what we used to call machine learning, which is this idea that you have this black box, you give the computer examples and you give it an outcome, and it just learns from that how to optimize. It goes backwards, fixes the weights, and now it gets better and better. That's the idea. And you showed this with your IOL formula that's AI based, that you can start with any formula and you make it better. Yeah. So I kind of took that idea myself and I used it for arcuate incisions. We do a lot of LRIs and arcuate incisions. We use the one of the lasers here. And I just wanted, I knew that there were some good calculators out there, but we wanted to really tailor it to our outcomes. And we did that by feeding in examples. So I created this arcuate calculator that's really worked well. And it uses a lot of new data points, derojas.info, little plug.
There you go.
And it works well. And again, it wasn't that hard to do, but it's the tools are out there. That's the, you know, basic machine learning, pre-LLMs, pre-ChatGPT. But I do think there's so much room for us to get better by leveraging these tools.
If you got an ophthalmologist who's listening, who just has an interest in this, doesn't know where to start, what would you recommend? Would you recommend one of these? There's actually a couple of good online courses through some of the universities for free. Do you recommend any of these?
I think it's important. You just have to decide like how deep do you want to go, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the first decision. So if you're going like all in deep, and it's hard to do this, you got to have time. And if you have kids, it's really hard. But if that's your goal, then I think it's still worthwhile to do like a course like the one I took, the Harvard CS50, which is it'll give you fundamentals to understand what, like, how do programs work, like, you know, basic just how to think, like, how does a computer work and how does software work. And I think that's important to get a foundation. But then the nice thing is that we're living in a world now where you can use these LLMs to learn anything,
right?
So it's so much easier now. I mean, it's still good to read books for foundations, and I think you can do courses, read books. But now you can just start, like, once you have a basic foundation, you can just start. So you can just ask the LLM, okay, I want to learn, help me create a simple program that does this and guide me step by step, every step along the way, explain to me the reasoning for that line of code and let's go, you know, and then it'll just like start and be like, try this and be like, oh, but how do I download that? I don't know what program do I need to even do that? And then it'll give you that. So you can just, this Q&A type style of customized learning, in my opinion, is one of the best ways to learn programming. So I would say, you know, start with some accredited sort of good course to get your feet wet, and then leverage the internet and leverage LLMs and just get started on a project.
Right.
That's the best way. Because then you learn by doing.
No, absolutely. You got to get your hands wet. You got to make some mistakes.
Just like surgery.
Well, soon we'll have that as well. I mean, obviously, you know, you heard the news. We had a world's first robotic cataract surgery done about a couple weeks ago.
That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting time. And obviously, the potential there is to have a lot more AI influence within it. And things that could be, let's say, protected. You analyze the data coming in, which is 4K cameras and 3D plus OCT imaging. You can say, okay, keep the capsule away from me. Don't let me damage the capsule. Little things like this that may be a huge, you know, improvement in the way we operate.
I agree. I think it was really awesome that you did that, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
You know, what's interesting is that whenever there's new technology like this, there are always going to be people that poo-poo it.
Of course. Believe me, I've read the comments online.
And there was some chatter, and it's just, I think when things are new, people get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just like, is this going to take over what I do? Is how could it be better than this? Or is this worth it financially? Yada, yada. You get all these arguments, right? But that's the thing. I think you just have to push the frontier, you know, whatever way it is. It's a commendable job just to see how far you can get, because you never know what's going to happen. It's not to say that's going to be like the final version, right? The one you did is amazing. And you showed that, I mean, the robotics is a whole other field other than AI that I think is amazing, because it's getting really good. You know, the fine tuned control with like Optimus from Tesla or these other robots that are coming out, you're going to see now real world AI. So you're going to see AI that doesn't just work in the world of bits, but works in the world of things. Yeah. And that's going to be a huge productivity boost for the economy. In my opinion, it might even be what finally helps lower the cost of medicine. You know, there's another startup I saw that they basically use robots to do a lot of tests, you know, on material science. So they just, the robots, the AI sort of helps the humans and the scientists devise the tests. And then you have like a lab where they're doing it with robotics. So you're seeing this, you can just get so much more throughput than you could with human workers. So I think that it's very cool. And I think the world of robotics, we're about to see a big change. What do you think? Do you think that, when do you think the robots will be doing the cataract surgery?
Well, it's hard to say. I think everything's going to be supervised, right? So same way, if you look back, I don't want to do radial keratotomy for keratorefractive surgery. I want to do, let's say, LASIK or PRK or lenticule extraction. But look at an extreme example, let's say trans PRK. So it goes right to the epithelium. What do you actually do? You step on a pedal. Right. So now it's not missing out your hands doing as much as your cognitive or your decision making or determination is a good candidate, et cetera, because the laser is already tracking the eye at 500 hertz. It's throwing down the ablation. Even for LASIK, okay, the femto makes the flap. You lift a flap, you do the ablation, you put the flap down. I mean, the laser cut it out. The robot can do that for sure.
Yeah.
I think right now we have robots kind of emulating the way we operate. Because now think about it, we sit temporally because, well, I need to access the eye and temporal limbs is pretty easy to get to. But maybe we could have a robotic system that doesn't have to emulate us. It can do an entirely different way of doing the cataract surgery, which who knows what is, right? So maybe you can make an incision like you couldn't do now. I can't do a nasal incision. It's just too kind of hard to get in there. But maybe that's the point that you do it. Maybe do I need to do this big rexus? Maybe there's another way we can make a smaller opening and then just go put a little propeller blade and spin it in the nucleus and emulsify the nucleus and suck it out. Who knows? I don't know.
Maybe you could have four instruments in the eye instead of two because you have four robotic hands. We're limited by two hands.
Right. Or let's say, yeah, for sure. Or even doing, let's say you do a vitrectomy in the future with a robot, partial plan of vitrectomy. You can control, let's say, two ports like you're doing now, but your third port with the light pipe, well, the light pipe, you can just track your instrument. You say, well, always have the light shining appropriately, you know, a millimeter in front of my vitrector. And it just, wherever you do, when that tracks, it moves. So a lot of new stuff will come. I think we have to start thinking, instead of emulating us, the robots, is there a different way we could do it with a robot?
I think what's interesting is that, like you're touching upon, I think as this technology evolves, and I think when robotics and AI come together, because right now it's a little more separate, like the robotics is the human-controlled robot, right? I think we're going to adapt as a species. I think that's the part we don't realize. It's not so much that we're creating this new class of workers, these robots. It's that that's going to change us as a species of humans and ophthalmologists. What is our role? And I think it is going to become a lot more, you're the supervisor, you're the thinker behind it, the problem solver, although that, you know, that you're going to be assisted and augmented by AI, but it's going to be a much more top. I love, you're like the CEO of the healthcare being distributed, you know, and you do have to be a backup. You know, the robots can fail. You have to get in there yourself. You have to have skills, fundamentals, but it's very interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to be, But I think we need to be open-minded. And again, I think we shouldn't just do things because it's cool. I mean, I think us that love technology, you know, are drawn to that. But at the end of the day, like if something is going to help patients and improve, has the potential at least to make things better, why wouldn't we be on board with that?
Right.
And then it's just selfish not to.
Right. And then, of course, all this just keeps evolving. I remember 15, 18 years ago, and I had my BlackBerry, and they came out with the first iPhone. And I was like, no, I like the BlackBerry. I need the keyboard. Well, now look where we are with the iPhone 17. It's like unbelievable. So, again, every generation will certainly get better and better. Look at phaco machines. And look at that, too. They told Kelman he was crazy, right? They kicked him out of everything. And then the first phaco machines were a little bit barbaric. I mean, look where we are now. These machines are unbelievable.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think it'll keep evolving. But yeah, I was quite surprised by a lot of the really negative comments. And there's even someone forwarded me, there's a whole Reddit thread where people are like throwing me under the bus. I'm like, okay, I'm not replying. It's very crazy. But
it's like, sorry for pushing the envelope, guys.
Yeah, I mean, maybe people feel threatened, I guess. Yeah. But I don't see why you would. I think it's my example, radial keratotomy to LASIK, it's no different. You shouldn't feel threatened by it. Certainly, it's a newer technology that has a huge potential. And time will tell where we end up with it.
It never hurts to explore.
Right. But I still think it's obviously an amazing thing to be an ophthalmologist, and we're not going to be replaced. We're going to be augmented. I think it'll be this will be a better version of me.
Right? That's right. So I think we're all going to be augmented in some way.
Yeah, you figure.
I think we already are. I mean, they've shown that doctors are now like using these LLMs to look up stuff. You know, it's such an easier. You're in clinic, you see something you're not sure of, and now you can just upload a picture of it, and it can tell you, it can give you a better differential than you could have figured out, or you just describe to it the findings, and it can help you. Why wouldn't you use that? You know, it's not to say that you're gonna believe it at face value, but it can definitely. I mean, how good are we at figuring out a differential diagnosis of 10 different diagnoses that we rarely see? We're all human, we forget, right. But the computer doesn't, you know, the LLM. So I don't know. I think it'd be silly not to. I think it's already making us better doctors. I think it is for me. I mean, you still use like Will's Eye and these trusted sources, but you can also get something that's a little easier to look up faster and maybe more attuned and updated, right? If you create one of these databases of all the PubMed articles, and you know, and you can search that in a way that like a semantic search where it understands the points and the ideas, and now you can search by ideas, not just by text. That's already out there.
Yeah, so, for sure. I mean, I just sit sometimes, I'll drive and I'm just thinking like, okay, what's the next thing? What should we do next? What's the next kind of project here? And I think it'll keep evolving and we'll keep getting, I think, deeper and deeper. But it'll be to the point like you're saying now. Yeah, I can just have it built into my slit lamp. Take a picture of this. Okay, what is this white dot syndrome? And then it'll throw up a differential for you. And you just have it built right in.
I already did this the other day. I had my nanny was having an issue with the vacuum cleaner. We didn't have the instruction manual. It was like one of the rings got misplaced or lodged in there. And I had no idea how to fix it. So I used the app on my phone and I did the video mode and I just had her hold it in real time. The video was watching what it was doing. It's like, okay, just pull that thing out. This is the ES5000 vacuum. Pull that out, turn it this way. I was doing it in real time and I fixed it.
That's wild.
The video and picture capabilities are getting wild.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's why I like to be on the forefront. So I spend a lot of my time, you know, I'm always reading this stuff, right? As hopefully we're all doing, but I'm also reading the AI stuff. I'm just reading that. I'm in the newsletters. I listen to the podcasts. You know, a few I could recommend, but I just want to stay on top of that because I feel like that's going to be it's going to change a lot of the stuff we're doing.
I'm impressed you're actually reading someone as young as you reading ophthalmology journals in like paper form.
They somehow kept coming in my mail. I don't even remember signing up for them. I think it's because if you're part of like the, you know, some of these organizations, they just mail them to you.
Yeah.
But I'm glad they kept coming because I read them.
No, but I like them. I just access them online. They access them on your device. I don't like to read paper. But it's charming.
This puts it right in my face. I have to. I can't ignore it. I either throw it in the garbage or I read it. So I might as well read it.
Yeah, I guess.
Whereas I get on my computer and then now I'm on social media for half an hour.
Well, that's the danger there too, right? We're going to find out in 10 years that social media is as bad for you as smoking was. You know, we found that out decades ago. I bet you'd be the same thing.
Probably. So, yeah. It has to be taken in moderation.
But I think it's a neat way of just getting information across very fast and also maybe even changing the way that peer reviewed is done, right? Peer reviewed means you submit an article, they send it to three reviewers who you don't know. And those three reviewers then decide whether or not it's going to be published.
What if they're having a bad day?
Right. Or what if they've got a personal vendetta? They got an issue against you.
Right.
Maybe it steps on their toes. Maybe you come up with something so interesting, let's say with lens calcs, and some of the grandfathers of the lens calcs say, no, we should not publish that.
That's right. But it's so pretty archaic. It's pretty archaic the way we do it. It's true. You just get, and I'm an editor for some of these things. They asked me to edit it. And you know, and I was sometimes I try not to accept the ones that I don't have expertise over, because I don't, you know, what do I know, right? Mm-hmm. But the ones that I have some expertise, I might help to edit. But you're right, it is very arbitrary. I mean, they should have a statistician in there reviewing it. Sometimes the stats are complicated, and a lot of us ophthalmologists don't know the nuances to that. And they should have, maybe that's where actually, you know, AI can help also, right? Just to kind of, as a cursory review in the beginning, and then bring it to the next level. But you're right, it's not, I think social media, like we've seen with, you know, especially now with all this talk with X and the Twitter and all this, it's bringing the power back to the people, and it's allowing us all to be able to publish and to share our information that we learned. But the question then is, how do you make sure there's quality control?
Well, the easy part is, that's the easy part. The quality control is everyone votes. If I put a video that's really good, I can see it in the comments, I can see it in the likes, I can see it in the views. If I put up a video that's not so great, well, the views tank. I mean, when I give a lecture, one of the reasons I'm so good at giving these lectures, like best of category coach, is because I already know what videos are super popular that people are going to love. I already know. I got 2,700 videos to choose from. I can say, let me see, okay, of my white cat or my capsule break videos, which one's got the most comments, most likes, most views? Let me use those, edit those again, and put that in my talk. So I know I'm going to come there and hit hour after video after video after video. It's going to be great, 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 because I already know it. I already tried it.
give the people what they want.
Right. I already know. I know ahead of time. And so then that, I was like, I'm pretty sure if I give this talk, that I'm pretty sure everyone else is going to love it, because they already have.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I guess, you know, the voting machine, the popularity, that's kind of how our democracy works, right?
Yeah.
We hope that leads to the truth. Yeah, that's true.
Good stuff gets pushed to the top for sure.
Yeah.
And so I think that's peer-reviewed. Is now these are actually my peers, right? I put the video that went up this morning on Cataract Coach has already received, who knows, 10,000 views from my peers. That's
and when you look at that video that has the 10,000 views, the highest views, is it one that has the most shock value, like a complication that's just people just drawn to it? Or do you consider independently that, yeah, this video is very valuable, I can see why it has 10,000 views? Or is it like, or does it have 10,000 views because it's just the most shocking?
So it can be either. So you got to look at that. So you could have that it's like, wow, look at that capsule broke. I can't believe that just happened. So that those obviously get a lot of views too. But the other ones get really great views. It's just like something really clever, a really smart surgical pearl. Mm-hmm. I got a video a couple of days ago where a surgeon sees a hole in the capsule, puts the IOL in as a scaffold, then goes back and figures out the other pieces. And, you know, that's a useful thing. And I also see how many people forwarded that. What's interesting, though, is when I put the same videos on YouTube and Insta, obviously, all the same video across platforms, but the Insta videos are edited differently.
Okay.
Because Insta, I only have 3 seconds to get your attention unless you swipe.
Do you edit all that?
I do everything.
Nice.
So you have to. Because if I on Insta, you don't want to see the big intro and the this. You will not wait 30 seconds for the good part. You will not. You'll wait 3 at most.
You're and a one-man. Are you a one-man show?
No, I have some help. But again, how can I teach a non-ophthalmologist how to edit? I can't. Right. I can't.
But it's, really, it's really amazing what you're doing. Let me just tell you, because, look, you're an excellent cataract surgeon and business person, all that type of stuff. But, you know, you've used, it's like what we were talking about. That doesn't explain you, though. You have so many interests, and you have so much curiosity in all these other realms that you've shown excellence in, and that's very inspiring, you know, because it's like it's like being the total human. I do believe, you know, that I was thinking about like what message would I want to impart on, you know, young doctors that have aspirations, young ophthalmologists. It's don't forget about your curiosity, you know, just keep. Yeah. Keep that curiosity alive, you know, that interest in trying new things, because I just see too often people get set in their ways and they just start looking at their job as just a job. Mm-hmm. And then they all of a sudden have no time for anything else. And then you just kind of, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy of misery.
Yeah. It becomes a grind. If you do that,
your life becomes a grind,
right?
You have to stay fresh and curious. It's kind of like your kids, you know, like when they first learn about something like that's so elementary to us, they're so excited.
Mm-hmm. You gotta keep the curiosity. I like that. That's right.
You know, and I think your channel does that
to a degree. We're doing okay with that, but yeah, I'm actually constantly impressed how even the channel grows. Now, Insta, I will predict, will take over the YouTube views in the next couple of years. Right now, I get 1.5 million Insta views a month. I'm getting about 2 to 3 million YouTube views, but I bet you Insta is growing so fast.
Mm. Interesting.
It's like, I think our attention spans get shorter and shorter. People are like, well, I just watch it on Insta. Because it's convenient. It already comes up in your feed.
Right.
You don't have to go anywhere else. I know my least used is going to cataractcoach.com, the actual website. Mm. And I look at the data too right now, 70-something percent is used on a mobile device. Only 30% of the views that say are on a desktop or laptop.
It's changing.
Yeah, it's very much changing. Yeah, so it's interesting to see how it all pans out.
Let me ask you one last. What about TikTok?
I don't do TikTok because the terms of service requiring me to install all that nonsense on my phone or access my whole phone is, I'm not game with that. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Because I know that their algorithm, I've heard from creators that it's you can get viral very fast on there.
So I don't want viral among the general population. I take pride in that people who watch my videos are overwhelmingly ophthalmologists. Hmm. They're not lay people. They're not patients. It's not a cute puppy video. It's a gross eyeball surgery to 99% of the population.
That's right. Yeah, that's good.
So I just want to keep my audience as ophthalmologists. And honestly, it's taken over this. Look at all the industry trade journals every year. Aren't they thinner and thinner and thinner, fewer and fewer pages? Slack Books just recently stopped publishing books. There's just no, just changes too much. It's like they literally closed their book publishing division.
Hmm.
It's like, yeah. Wow, that's a new world. Well,
you're getting with the times and you've stayed up with all of it. That's great.
Yeah. Well, it's like you said, it's the curiosity. But the other thing, my secret weapon is, honestly, I'm not the smartest ophthalmologist. Most ophthalmologists are geniuses. I'm not. But I'm a donkey. I can work really, really hard. That's what I've always made up for anything else, but I can just work harder.
I don't think you give yourself enough credit. I also think you're super smart, but anyway.
Yeah, it's certain ways. Yeah. But again, your kids are too young. What do your kids are teenagers? Then they'll tell you, Dad, you're not that smart.
Maybe that's good. It'll bring my ego down, all of our egos down, our kids, right?
Anyway, yeah. Well, Keenan, what a fun conversation we've had here. I really like the AI discussion we had. I like that you like to keep curious. I think that's a great thing. I'll probably put that on the title slide here. Keep your curiosity. Keep learning. And then I also really admire, though, you know, how you came right out of your training and just kind of hit the ground running and really ramped up to be very successful in what you're doing. So congratulations on all the above.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And your channel, when I started practicing, it became bigger. And I just think it's so important to have resources like your channel to just push the envelope, see new things that you haven't encountered, and try to challenge yourself. You know, you see something different and you're like, wow, that could be better. Try it out yourself and keep yourself challenged. I think that's what's better for your patients. And that's what's better for the field as a whole, right? Yeah. We don't need more ophthalmologists that are just set in their ways and they never progress past what they learned in residency and fellowship.
Right. For sure. For sure. It's going to keep changing. The robots are coming, people. As well as the AI. Remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach video every single day, a new Cataract Coach podcast every week on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you get a podcast, you get the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, we also have our sister channel, retinarounds.com, with retina videos and a retina rounds podcast. So until next time, I'll check you later.